You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh boy.
Large wedge tornado coming up into Tuscaloosa.
A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
We can expect at least another 2 to 4 inches for the night.
The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Mississippi.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening to you, and thank you for joining us live here on The Weather Junkies. We are happy to be here. It is a beautiful evening here in Connecticut, as always. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show from Bristol, Connecticut, alongside Dakota Smith out in Colorado. Dakota.
Hey, Tyler, and hey, everyone. Thanks for joining us tonight. I actually have changed location pretty permanently for the time being. I just moved to Meade, Colorado, kind of the middle of nowhere, Colorado, from Fort Collins, but it is still hot as ever here. It's upper 90s, I think, station down in Longmont Ridge 98. So not a great day to be outside in the sun. Pretty hazy, too. I didn't look at the data, but I'm assuming the air pollution quality is pretty bad out here. Usually it's typically ozone that's bad out here. But it's hot and sunny, so I can't complain that much. And how's the weather out there?
It's great. We still don't have any humidity. We haven't had any oppressive humidity yet this year. The National Weather Service office actually in Boston has a dew point climatology that I cannot find for some reason. But I so want to find out what the average is and what the records are for these dates, because it's unprecedented how long we've been with no real humidity. I'm loving it. It's just sunny day after day and gorgeous. Yeah. It's even a little chilly at night sometimes.
Can't beat that.
It's already what, June 16th? June 16th.
Yeah, what's the highs this week?
Like 80.
Oh, that's nice.
It looks like we'll be near 90 early next week with maybe a little humidity, but as you know, when you don't have that oppressive humidity, it might feel a little hot in the sun, but as soon as the sun sets or you walk into the shade, it's completely fine, even when you get up close to 90. So
yeah,
I don't know. And you really can't get much severe weather when the dew point is very low. So
yeah, that's how it's been out here, too. I think the dew points are in like the mid-30s, lower 30s. So not too much to complain about. Our guest tonight is in the same area as you, Tyler. We have Andrea Thompson. She's the senior science writer at Climate Central with a focus on extreme weather and climate change. She graduated from Georgia Tech with a BS in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. And she also got a master's in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences as well from Georgia Tech. And then she got an environmental reporting master's from NYU. Andrea, thanks for joining us tonight.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what's the weather out there? You're in Brooklyn, I hear. How's it out there?
It's pretty similar to Tyler. It's been really mild. It was a little cloudy today during the day, but it looks like it's cleared up. Sun's going down right now, so just seeing the last rays.
Yeah, not much to complain about. That's
exactly
always good to hear. I grew up in Maryland, and sometimes that humidity could get to you. Well, let's jump in right into the tweets of the week. We have four of them today. I'll start out with one from Climate Central, and that's where Andrea works, so I'm sure she can chime in on this one. But this tweet says, this is what 100 years of warming looks like in every national park, and it shows an awesome GIF of the warming trend from 1916 to 2015 with cool pictures in the background changing for each national park. You can follow them at Climate Central. And I believe this is a series of pieces by Brian, a writer over there, and he's doing all these pieces on national parks, which I think is awesome because I've been trying to get to as many as I can in the past few years. Andrea, do you know what the motivation was for this?
I think, you know, Brian kind of has that same love for the national parks and the outdoors, and I think he'd been kind of mulling over a story about this for a while, and this year happens to be the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, so it was a nice kind of hook to explore this.
Gotcha. Very cool.
I have to say, as a graphics designer, I love your graphics. They're amazing.
Oh, thanks.
Tyler's very tricky, too, by the way, so that is a high praise from Tyler.
Yeah, we're lucky. We have a great team of graphics people who, you know, they do graphics for our program that provides graphics to TV meteorologists, but they also provide graphics to us, so it's nice when we have ideas for stories. We can just say, hey, can you work up something like this up for us?
Do you know if they do a lot of their work in Photoshop or something else?
I don't actually know what they do it in. Yeah, I could find out, but yeah, I don't. I just ask them to make one, and then they perform their magic.
Our next tweet is one that I chose. It's a tweet from IBM about their new weather model, I want to say, called Deep Thunder. And as you probably know, IBM bought the digital assets of the weather company not too long ago, and we're starting to see some signs of what they plan to do, but it's a pretty interesting proposition. They have this model called Deep Thunder, and they're using other models. It looks like a version of the WRF, and they say that they can forecast how people are going to react to weather, all these crazy different things. And of course, if you can pin that down, then businesses will be interested in buying that data because they can increase or decrease supply or staffing. Dakota, do you know anything about this?
Is this the one that they called the world's best model?
I'm not sure. Is that what's their other name that they have for a model? I think it might be the other one. I can't think of the name. It's like one word. This one's Deep Thunder.
Deep Thunder, huh? Well, it seems like all this stuff is happening with IBM, and we haven't really been able to see any of the final product yet.
I think Watson is.
Oh, Watson, one. Right? Yeah, he's more of an AI type of deal. Yeah, I really just want to see actual product for them. I mean, I know they're doing everything with the weather company now, so all the digital stuff that the weather company makes is presumably IBM backed. But I would love to see kind of the advancement that they're going to make when the merger happened.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what we see on the public side of this.
Yeah, hopefully, a lot of people are up in arms about it, but you know, if it improves forecasts and streamlines forecasts, I don't have a problem with it at all. Let's go on to our next tweet, and this was kind of an obscure tweet, but I thought it was really cool. It's from Tanya Giamanco. I hope I said that right. I doubt I did. But she tweeted out a look at the two craziest stones we saw today during the IBHS hail study. You can follow her at Tanya_BG_WX. And it's a picture of, it looks like they did a 3D scan of these hailstones. And that's just mind-blowing. That's like, that is so cool. And I can't imagine the level of understanding they're going to get from these 3D scans. And I'm assuming they're going to make a database of all this stuff, which they can compare it to, like, you know, different supercells and what kind of hail they made. And so I think this is really cool. Very visual visual data, so I think that's awesome.
Yeah, pretty intense. And our final tweet is actually a very current tweet. It is from Ann Livingston, and he is responding to Ryan Hanrahan. They are talking about the LWX radar, which is in Sterling, Virginia, and the fact that storms are coming through the region and the radar is not in what we call sales mode. Sales essentially means that the radar completes a low-level scan more frequently than the other scans. So to put that in terms of minutes, when you're in, say, meso sales mode, you can get a radar scan every minute. When you're not, it's more like every 5 minutes. And I actually have radar scope open, and the radar is generating an image every 5 minutes with severe thunderstorms rolling through. And they have the capability to switch the radar into sales or mesosales mode, which would go from 5 minute updates to 1 minute updates. That would you call that a 500% increase in updates speed?
Yeah. So why aren't they? I guess there's no reasoning that they're not in the mode, considering there is a big old supercell that went through.
I'm not sure. I can't imagine that they are prevented. I mean, what would the excuse be? The software is not working. I mean, the radar's working.
Yeah.
But the comment from Ryan Hanrahan was, this is beyond embarrassing and unacceptable. And then Ian says he tries to stay out of bashing the National Weather Service.
I do too, because I respect what they do, but sometimes...
Well, I mean, come on, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, no, sometimes you have to criticize them where they need to be criticized, but...
Looks like there's even a supercell on the southern side of that radar scan.
Yeah, and that was a confirmed tornado, I believe, in West Virginia. I saw some pictures earlier.
I mean, we like to think that we have people watching the show that may not understand all of this, but to break it down into simpler terms, this very well could be just operator error, someone not paying attention to the settings on the radar.
Yeah.
I guess it's good enough for government work.
Tyler.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Andrea, are you chiming in there?
No, just...
Oh, okay. Yeah, I like to not think that, but maybe we'll get into this in a different day. Maybe get someone from Sterling on the show.
This is the nation's capital. It's not out in the, you know, the cornfields.
Well, let's move on. We'll move on to our main segment tonight, and that's writing in climate science. And we're very excited to have Andrea with us tonight. So I just wanted to get kind of off the bat a feel for what your motivation was to do this kind of work.
Sure. It was a little bit of a circuitous route to you know, climate writing and journalism, but, you know, as you said, I went to Georgia Tech and I studied earth and atmospheric science, which was mainly meteorology and atmospheric chemistry. And I kind of discovered while I was there that I enjoyed explaining science and writing about it more than actually doing it, which you will find, I think, a lot of science journalists will say that. So I found this science journalism program at NYU and came and just really, really loved it. I, you know, did several internships. I did with NPR Science Friday, a couple other places, my old place of employment, Life Science, and just really enjoyed it because I got to write about all this cool science and interview these people who are doing really amazing work and explain it to people. But obviously, because of my background, you know, a lot of my main interest was in weather and climate, and a position opened up at Climate Central, and I jumped on it since extreme weather was kind of what I was most interested in.
Gotcha. And so you had kind of you worked at space.com. Did you kind of similar things there?
Yeah, so it's two sister sites, space.com and Live Science.
Okay.
So yeah, it's essentially the same idea, except I was, you know, I wrote about science much more broadly there. So I wrote about Mars, I wrote about neuroscience, I wrote about weather, climate science. So, and, you know, coming to Climate Central kind of let me focus on what I was most interested in.
Gotcha. So what kind of feedback, it seems like climate science would be one of the crazier things in science to write about because it's, you know, pretty political.
Yeah,
I'm curious. What kind of feedback do you get on a daily basis, and how do you handle that kind of feedback?
That's a good question, and it's kind of changed over my career. I think when I would say the bulk of the response you get tends to be from people who don't buy into the idea of global warming.
Yeah.
And they're very vocal. They leave a lot of comments. You get some tweets every now and then, you know, now that Twitter's a thing. For the most part, you kind of learn to just brush it off. You don't really, you know, if someone has a real question and is trying to understand, then I will definitely engage with them. But I would say the vast majority of people that leave a lot of those comments aren't actually, you know, trying to get more information. They're trying to kind of, I guess, catch you in saying something. So I used to, when I first started out, I probably engaged a bit more and really tried to convince people, but it takes a lot of time, and a lot of the things that people ask about are things that, you know, the answers to that are already out there. People have, you know, answered them a million times, so it's kind of not worth my time to go through it yet again.
Gotcha.
Yeah, so, but you also get people who, you do occasionally get the person who's, you know, I really love the story, I understand this so much better now, and that's actually the kind of people that I think we're kind of, most of us are writing for.
So, you went to Georgia Tech knowing that you wanted to major in Earth and Atmospheric Sciences?
I didn't. I actually first was interested in astronomy, but I knew I was interested in science. And so I was going to be a physics major, but the physics department there, at least at the time, was much more theoretical physics than any kind of applied physics. But I discovered the Earth and Atmospheric Science program, which was, you know, one of the smaller ones on campus. But I also had a natural interest in weather, too, and so it seemed like a good fit.
Are there any major differences between a meteorology program and Earth and Atmospheric Sciences?
Yeah, so for the whole idea of the Earth and Atmospheric Science program was that you learn about the planet as a whole because, you know, that the atmosphere isn't, you know, by itself. It interacts with the land surface. It interacts with the oceans. You know, the chemistry that's going on, you know, within the Earth eventually affects the atmosphere. So the idea was to give you a very holistic view of the Earth. So you took geochemistry, you took geophysics. So, you know, you had to learn about how volcanoes work, even if you were more interested in, you know, studying air pollution or meteorology.
So it's pretty neat to see someone working for Climate Central that doesn't come from a diehard meteorology background, because I think a lot of times that's the case.
Yeah.
What are the other people you work with like? Are they similar to your path, or are they from meteorology backgrounds, or?
So it differs. On the journalism side, I'd say Brian Kahn is probably, you know, he's really interested in weather. He studied, I think, environmental science, if I remember correctly. My two other colleagues, their fellow science writers, came from a more journalism background, but happened to be interested in climate science and energy and stuff. On some of the other side, you know, on our more research side, I'd say those folks came more from a meteorology background or from a data analysis background.
So I thought that was really cool that you had kind of a holistic, they had a holistic approach to it, because when I love the weather. I just, you know, looking at clouds and looking at storms, but I really wanted to get more into the land surface interactions, and I either had to go outside of the department to do that, and that's tough to tie in with your program, or take, there's three classes that, you know, you could take one of them, and if you didn't get everything there, then you have to take another one, but I think that's really cool that they have that kind of approach, and you can get a lot out of it, just a bachelor's degree.
For sure, it definitely expanded my knowledge, and it came in handy in the career I ultimately decided on, because, you know, I can write about earthquakes or volcanoes and have, you know, there's some background there to draw on.
Yeah, it might actually be good for broadcast people, because a lot of times they're the science person, you know, at the station. I'm sure Tyler has to deal with that. So I wanted to ask a little bit more about your writing, because like I said earlier, climate science rain really intrigues me because there's a lot of different aspects to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a focus on extreme weather and climate change.
Yes.
And recently I've seen, I guess not just recently, but in the past few years, I've seen a lot of articles that put extreme weather on climate change and either say, you know, it was enhanced by climate change or something to that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think it's absolutely warranted. Other times I think it's a little hasty. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious what your procedure is on these kind of topics. Like, is it, do you wait for publications or do you wait for people to chime in on it? What's mm-hmm. that process like?
So it can differ depending on, you know, the event, how easy it is to tie to warming. So when you have a heat wave, something like that, mm-hmm. you know, that's something where we very clearly understand how rising temperatures are going to affect the likelihood of those. There's a very, you know, one-to-one correlation. You know, there's not as many variables involved to say something like a hurricane, right. where that's much, much harder. So for that, we might just, you know, go and ask a few people who are, you know, who are studying heat waves, you know, say, hey, is this the kind of thing, you know, that we can expect to happen more often? And they'll weigh in on that. You have, you know, this kind of nascent science of attribution, extreme event attribution, which we have a few folks working on. And some of it, you know, you have the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society that once a year does a kind of a roundup of studies of events from the past year, that they try and do studies that basically, you know, look statistically, how are the odds of something like this happening with warming? And there's a few different ways to do that. You can look through the observational record and see how the odds are changing. You can do use computer models to compare the current climate to a climate without warming and see how that changes the odds. We have people who are trying to do more real-time attribution studies. So, you know, within a few days to a week about after an event. And again, that's one where most of that tends to be temperature events just because it's much easier. And you can actually find records that are long enough. Because if you're going to use observational records, you have to have ones that are, you know, long enough to actually find trends. They're trying to do some with precipitation, too.
Mm-hmm.
For things like, say, tornadoes or hurricanes, we kind of try and put the context in more by saying, okay, so here's what people have started to look into on how warming might impact tornadoes or what we think, you know, how it might impact hurricanes in the future. So, you know, it really depends on the event you're talking about.
So I think that, I think you guys set the bar when it comes to writing about that kind of stuff because the process you just lined out, I don't think anyone could critique that in any sort of, or criticize that in any sense. You might not know the answer to this question. Do you know if that's a similar process that not a science-based organization uses?
I think it can depend a little bit. You know, there are definitely you know, outlets and publications that aren't, say, science ones, but that have extremely good science reporters, like, say, the New York Times or the Associated Press, which has two really good veteran reporters, Seth Bornstein and Malcolm Ritter. So I think there are, you know, outlets that aren't science outlets that do probably use a similar procedure and are really, you know, understand the science. You know, others perhaps less so, and they have to do a little more digging to kind of put everything in its proper context versus those of us who write about this all the time and kind of have that context with us all the time.
Okay, gotcha. So that, yeah, that your situation sounds great, or not even your situation. Your job sounds great. I think about what kind of position it'd be to like write for kind of a larger company and mm-hmm. And being the science person at that company, and having that pressure to write what you want, but the pressure of getting clicks, you know, getting the views.
Mm-hmm.
Do you Do you ever have that? Or to me, it doesn't seem like it, but I'm just curious if that's something that you have to make sure you get those views and get those clicks.
Yeah, it's something that's kind of probably in the background. I think it's a little different for us because we're a nonprofit. So, you know, our money to operate isn't as, you know, clearly tied to
right.
our traffic.
Yeah.
Although we have to say, like, look, we're reaching people. This is why you should, you know, fund
yeah.
us. I think for other organizations that are, you know, that are for-profit probably have a lot more pressure in that regard. It's not really something that we really discuss, you know, certainly on a day-to-day basis, but we'll kind of every so often step back and review, like say, okay, you know, we can tell that certain kinds of stories do well. Like El Nino stories did really well for us. People were really interested in El Nino. Understand?
Yeah.
Even if some of us probably got a little tired of it after a while. you know, records tend to do well because they're things that kind of grab people's attention. You know, you mentioned the National Park Service GIF. You know, when you have visuals like that that can grab people, especially on social media, that will kind of help those stories do well. But yeah, it's actually one of the nice things about working here is that there's a little less pressure to, you know, to feed the beast, I guess.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned pressure, and Dakota, I believe we've had Bernadette on the show.
Yeah.
This may be somewhat of a repeat question, but mm-hmm. I might as well ask, what is the funding like, the funding sources like for Climate Central? I know you mentioned pressure,
mm-hmm.
You know, clicks and everything. What's the funding like, and then we'll elaborate on that.
Sure. So I kind of purposely don't have a lot of visibility into the nitty-gritty of the process. We have a couple people who go out and work to get people to donate money to us. It's usually foundations, sometimes individual people. We've gotten various grants that we apply for. I'm trying to remember what some of them have been. Some of them are, you know, specific to fund certain research projects. So some of them fund, say, our attribution research. Some of them may fund our TD Metz program, the one that Bernadette runs. There aren't actually any specific funding for the journalism side. We're sort of pulled from whatever the main pot is. But yeah, so we have a dedicated group of people, or you know, that go out and you know, try and lobby for us to get money.
And as far as I can tell, there's no advertising on the website?
Correct.
Interesting. We have a Twitter comment here. It mm-hmm. is from the Nantucket Visitors Guide, islandofnantucket.info. They want to know about Wendy Schmidt, a founding member and corporate secretary of Climate Central. Do you know Wendy Schmidt?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I don't know her personally. She did, I think, help get the organization off the ground. I think she's still involved somewhat, you know, at, like, with the board and things, but I don't know a lot about her role at the, you know, the ins and outs of it, but I know that she still has some involvement with the group.
All right, very good. Interesting question here. Some people would say that you never cover perhaps some of the positives of climate change.
Mm.
What is the belief on that? So an example I can think of is in the North, I would say that probably most people use oil to heat their houses or
mm-hmm.
their homes or their businesses.
Me too.
In a warmer climate, there's less heating to be done and less oil to be burned. And you could argue that with more air conditioning, you know, that could be powered by either wind power or hydroelectric power. Mm-hmm. So what's the policy on positive stories about climate change?
Yeah, I'd say there's no particular policy that, you know, we have to cover negative versus positive stories. It's kind of, you know, a lot of what we write about kind of depends on what research is being done. And I would say most of the research looks, I don't think it's a purposeful thing, but happens to look at, you know, or I don't even think it sets out to look at negative impacts. It just says, okay, how is this, say, going to impact this ecosystem? And then looks at how, you know, what happens. you know, I think some stories would tend to, you know, you can say, okay, this warming might, you know, expand the range of this particular animal, but, you know, will shorten the range of this one. So as long as everything's kind of in context. But yeah, there's no particular, you know, if we had a story that like, hey, this warming is benefiting this thing, just because it's a positive impact doesn't mean we wouldn't do a story.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I have a follow-up to that. So what is your kind of, how do you go about picking something to write about? Is it purely just your interest, or is it a lot of times like the research that's being done at the current time?
So it's kind of a mix of all of the above. You know, we keep track. All the major journals send out every week kind of a roundup of their top or the studies they think will be of most interest to people. And I'd say every science journalist keeps an eye on those. You kind of keep an eye out on press releases. I keep a close eye on Twitter, especially, you know, being the person who writes about weather, because it's a really great way to see the weather that's happening all over the place, you know, not just in the U.S., but in the world. You know, I'll have certain things that get updated, say, once a week or every day that I check out, like the National Snow and Ice Data Center updates their sea ice coverage every day, and they usually do like a write-up once a month, so I keep an eye out for that in case there's something noteworthy to write about. You know, studies, it kind of depends, you know, if it's very technical or something where it's really only of interest to the people who are studying that thing, but wouldn't necessarily be of interest to the public. I might just kind of file it away until the next time I write about it, just to, you know, something to keep in mind. You know, some of it is just developing sources. So, you know, as you interview scientists, you kind of expand your Rolodex. use a term that doesn't really exist anymore. and, you know, sometimes you'll just email them and say, hey, what are you working on? What's going on right now in your field? You talk to them at meetings when you go. Meetings are a really good way to see kind of, to get an idea of new trends in areas of research, because you have so many studies there, things being presented at once. So a lot of it's just, you know, getting into it. And, you know, I've been doing this for, you know, a decade now, so I know a lot of the players. I know what the stories we were reporting on 5-10 years ago were versus now, and kind of seeing where they trend.
What do you have a favorite thing that you like to write about?
I actually, probably some of my favorite things are tornadoes and hurricanes, just because they're endlessly fascinating. Okay. Those can be harder, especially tornadoes, if you're writing about them on a, you know, anomaly climate site. But, you know, some folks like Harold Brooks have been doing some really interesting kind of exploratory research looking into, well, how do we think tornadoes, you know, could be impacted in terms of, you know, the broad environment they form in.
So one of the things we struggle with as communicators is providing examples of what things may be like in the future, not abstract examples like videos or graphics on the internet, but examples that are based in what's happening outside our window. So, like, for example, Hurricane Sandy, you have all these odd events that are happening. How do you relate that to climate change without making the egregious error of saying a single event is because of climate change?
Right. Yeah, you know, it's a really fine line, and it's really tricky. You have to be really careful. You know, you can't say global warming caused Hurricane Sandy, but you can say, so, you know, the sea level, the surge that we saw from Sandy, that's something, you know, we're probably going to face more of in the future, even if it's not from hurricanes, because, you know, nor'easters are something that impacts New York City all the time, and, you know, one of the unappreciated impacts of those is storm surge. So you can say, this is the kind of storm surge we will probably face more often, and, you know, clearly we are not even prepared for it now. So it's just kind of walking that fine line and saying, you know, maybe, you know, a heat wave that I'm trying to think of a good recent example, there have been some of the ones in India recently, you know, we can say, we know that these temperatures like these are going to happen more and more often. We're going to see what was maybe a 1 in 20-year event become, you know, a 1 in 5-year event. And so giving those concrete examples, but being careful to say, you know, we can't say without, you know, a dedicated study whether this particular event was the result or it affected by warming.
Yeah, and you always have, you know, an odd event that doesn't happen that often, and
right.
Those have always occurred. But no, I think that's very good advice. I think the problem that we always battle is with the media. Everyone mm-hmm. in the media wants to make it sound like death and destruction and the world is ending. You know, every tornado occurs without warning.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to communicate not only weather information but also climate information mm-hmm. in this environment when everything has to be the worst that's ever occurred and blah, blah, blah. So I think that's potentially, you know, makes Climate Central more important because there is a voice out there that has, you know, facts in mm-hmm. not quite hyped up like you would see on the national news or something like that.
Right. Yeah, and I think there are plenty of other outlets to do that too. It's just with, you know, with the internet and the proliferation of places for people to get their news, it's a lot harder to find those kind of reliable sources.
It absolutely is, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Tyler, I was going to say that Weathershift might be a good resource for showing people what it's going to be like in the mm-hmm. future, because you can type in your town and get your forecast and then see what that forecast might be 20 or 30 years in the future. Normally it's temperature that you're looking at on there, but still an awesome product at weathershift.com.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last time we talked about Weathershift, it was still in its infancy.
Yeah.
Oh, it says version 2.0. maybe I'm on the wrong website. But I think one of the things that Dakota and I talked about after that episode mm-hmm. was, like, how come we never asked? You know, Weathershift sounds like a great idea, but it always has some kind of climate linkage next to the forecast, as if every single forecast and every single hour has mm-hmm. a link to the changing climate.
Well, I think the purpose of it is to show you what it would be. It's you know, it gives you your forecast without the climate part with it, but then it gives you what it could be
mm-hmm.
If trends continue. Yeah, maybe it's tougher for the layman to kind of, you know, parse those out, but that's to me what I got from Weathershift.
Yeah, I think the idea was to give the weather with the context of climate to say, okay, here's what the temperature is today, but what, you know, the graph that might show up has nothing to do with what the exact temperature is today. It's just, you know, so if you look right now for New York City, it says it's 71 degrees and cloudy, and it says June's in the Northeast are heating up, and then there's, you know, the graph showing June average temperatures, and so that's independent of whatever the exact temperature today is.
Is Weathershift your home page?
It is not. I don't actually have a home page.
Okay.
I just have
it
the kind of
It sounded like
Google.
You had it all called up, ready to go.
No, I just have, because you guys brought it up, so I looked it up.
I'll make a bookmark. So we asked this to everyone, and I had a final question here. If you were to give advice, I guess in your case this would be perfect for people who want to, you know, pursue science but want to be on the writer side of it and the communication side of it. What kind of advice would you give to up-and-coming science writers?
I think, yeah, I've been asked this before, and I think two basic things, you know, read a lot, find the things, you know, the types of writing that you might want to do, and read a lot of it. You know, find writers that are, like, you know, they're really good, or I like how their style. Just read a ton, and then write. The best way to learn writing is to do it. You know, have a blog, you can tweet, you know, anywhere. You know, I went the route of going to journalism school, but plenty of journalists have started out, you know, in internships at, you know, say newspapers or now a lot of digital properties. So that's, you can kind of get into it that way, but, you know, just start doing it.
That's good. Find experience wherever you can get it.
Mm-hmm.
Great advice. I'm curious, what do you have coming up next, and where can people find your writing?
So, what do I have coming up next? Let's see. Oh, I'm writing about the heat wave in the Southwest. I should have something up on that tomorrow. It's been a little delayed from today. The NOAA's temperatures came out, so I need to get up. I am also hoping to do some more on maybe one last story on El Nino now that it's officially gone, and then I'm sure I'll be doing stuff on La Nina eventually. And you can find my work at Climate Central. You can go to, under What We Do, there is a thing, a little tab that says staff, and you can find me, or you can click on stories, and any story, you can click on the author's name, and it'll take you to a whole list of all their stories.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us, and thanks for answering our grilling questions. hope to have you on sometime soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And if you want to follow us elsewhere, you can follow us on Twitter at the WX Junkies. We're also on Facebook, so check us out there. You can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, or iTunes. And if you're on Stitcher, give us a rating or review, whether it's good or bad. We just want to hear from you. Tyler, send us out.
Yes, we're excited that you joined us this evening. And next week, we'll be back same time Thursday evening at 8 p.m. We hope you'll join us right here next week.
Cow. I gotta go, Julia. We got cows.